storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's your brother, Iron Man. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast segment episode. There's a decision that we as a country are going to have to make. I've been talking a lot about decisions lately, so this is another one. This is actually a major one, though. And here I'm talking about us as a general populace. We keep being told that this is a democratic republic. And I have maintained, and conservatives maintain, that this is not a democracy, this is a republic. That's a reality, that's a fact. Elections do not make you a democratic society. Authoritarian countries have elections. Okay? That doesn't make you democratic. What makes you a democracy-based society is how far down economically is the power shared between those who have the most in the society and those who have the least. If we were going to be truthful, if we were really going to be truthful, Europe has been engaged in a Third World War since the end of the Second World War. It has been led by the United States, but it's still, Europe has been right along with it. Even though it may not agree with the tactics that the U.S. takes sometimes, Anglo-European powers have benefited from this war, and they have done nothing of significance to really prevent it. That war is a war against democracy. You can call it communism, you can call it socialism, you can call it whatever you want. But when you have a mass of people who say, we want this type of government because we believe that it is the natural extension of our desires, and then you have Europe and the United States coming in and saying, oh, no, 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 no. No, you don't. Our corporations have to feed on you. And if you do not kowtow to what we want, we'll first hit you with debt that you can't pay. Sound familiar, ladies and gentlemen? We'll hit you with debt that you can't pay. Then we'll hit you with sanctions because you won't pay it. Sound familiar, ladies and gentlemen? And then, if that all doesn't work, we're going to send in the Marines, the guns, the people who will kill a bunch of you and not give a crap about how many of you children, how many of your children, how many of your teachers die. Now, this isn't to say that, you know, soldiers don't have nightmares and stuff about this, because they do. But from a policy perspective, and I'm not talking here just about Congress, I'm talking the Pentagon too. You kill 100 people, you know, that's collateral damage. That's just a cost of doing business. Their war against democracy internationally has really been pronounced, yet it is something that we refuse to talk about. Not only has the war against democracy existed overseas, but it has also existed here in the country. Now, that war has been defined as one against radicalism, which is funny because the right wing, and even some of your centrists, your moderates, like to say that right wingers can be radicalized, and yet right wingers always talk against radicalization. So you can't have it both ways. Yes, these people are activated, but they aren't radicals. They're nihilists. I keep trying to tell people that, but they don't want to listen. That war here in America against democracy has resulted in some pretty stark outcomes. Unions, which by any account are democracy-driven forces. I have a show, a segment that I recorded way back during the 2020 primary season, where I try to explain rapidly what unions actually are. And I have to really get that to you guys because there's, when you look at what unions should be and where they should be heading and where they are today, it's, we have corporate unions. We do not have labor unions. We don't have labor unions. We have corporatist unions. We have unions that are tools of corporations. I'm not saying that you don't have some unions that are more flexible than others, but they don't function in the way that unions should function and what they should be aiming for. They are, unions at their basic level is a democracy-driven force. You've had unions demobilized. You've had unions absolutely fragmented and torn apart. You've also had the basis for educating the populace in their role in keeping the country democratic, keeping the country moving forward on a democracy-based pathway. You've had those pathways shredded. And all of that has been to the benefit of corporations. At the same time, you've had this rising of a managerial class that looks down in disdain on the general populace. Yes, they talk about democracy, they talk about freedom and all the rest of the garbage. And here, it's, you know, conservatives fall into this as much as your moderates do. All of them, by the way, are Republican. Not in the sense of party, but in the sense of the system that they want to forward. And if you just listen to some conservative intellectuals, they'll tell you that. So, obviously, I think you can see where I'm going with this, what the decision is that we're going to have to make. But that decision needs, you know, I want to parse it out a little bit for you. The decision that does have to be made is whether or not this country will become more democracy-based, more democracy-driven, or more authoritarian. One of the most interesting, unreported realities latent in a Republican-style government is the authoritarian factor. The myth that people have been projecting over the last 30, 40 years that, oh, you can have a democratic republic. feels to me, from an intellectual standpoint, as genuinely misleading. What do I mean? I mean, the lie itself serves a purpose to protect the status quo. So you think that the status quo doesn't need changing, when in fact it does. How could we need changing if a republic is also a democracy? That's just untrue. In a republic, you can go all the way back to Rome, first republic in Europe. You can go all the way back to Rome. That republic let people vote. And just like in the United States, we use that to talk about the economic realities, so that's the wrong word. The group of people who were able to vote expanded, not often out of the generosity of the Romans, but often out of people pushing the Romans to the point of, okay, fine. We're expending too much repelling you, so now we'll let you vote, and maybe you'll have a little power, probably not. But hey, you're not going to read the fine print. We're just going to screw you, and your vote's not going to matter that much. Sound familiar? Voting is not indicative of a democracy. Republican governing forms always, from the Romans forward, have relied on authoritative methods of governing. And as long as that authoritative method produces stabilizing and balancing results at what we call the grassroots level, where the ordinary people exist at, that authoritarianism is applauded, awarded, and adhered to. But as soon as those hierarchical structures bend and break the masses first will use, and again, I'm using Rome as an example, because they really did set the template. The masses, afraid of the power of the authoritarians, will use the channels available to them to try to enact change. But when that fails to produce their desired change, or sometimes weakened change, instead of rebelling, something strange happens. Because some people will rebel. But the most part, looking at Rome, they don't rebel. Why? Because in a republican system, the identification of citizenhood, of your civic duty, is to the state. Now listen to me, don't get sidebarred by me using that phrase. The state, we have to understand, is a composite of the governing mechanisms and the vision behind those governing mechanisms, which are upheld often to the point of being unwritten or even unarticulated by those who are in power to use the levers of power. So those at the top of the society. As the citizenry, as the body politic, particularly the part that pushes forward the body politic, the legs, as one book that I have says, the general populace embodies the vision which is cast from the people at the top. when that vision is no longer feasible and becomes distorted, thus producing a fragmented, disjointed, and often conflicting upper class, that same mentality gets reflected onto the populace and becomes expressed through the populace. This is something that most philosophers have missed. The top, is not a reflection of the bottom in a republic. The bottom, the 99%, is a reflection of the top. The more mental, psychological, and emotional disharmony that exists at the top of the society, the more that same disharmony, fragmentation, uncomfortability will exist at the bottom. The role, therefore, of democracy was to diffuse the pressures that are created often by the egocentric realities of life, and particularly at the upper regions of life, which causes one to constrict their vision. You only see what's in front of you and around you. And as long as things are good for you, you don't pay attention to what's actually happening outside of your bubble. And because you don't pay attention to what's outside of your bubble, you don't recognize the power sometimes that you have. And when you do recognize the power that you have, you use it in a destructive instead of constructive way. And you are too blind to see that. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the Republic was meant to create a system which cascaded downward the mental vision of the elites. Whether they meant to do it or not, that's what happened. Thus, when the elites were in harmony, when the elites were focus-driven on the Commonwealth, so wasn't the populace. But as soon as there began to be distortions, the same thing happened with the populace. And often the populace, this is the most brilliant thing that I learned when it came to the Republican governing method, and particularly the spiritual structure that is afforded to the Republican governing method. Oftentimes, the populace will begin to actualize distortions that have been latently hidden in the subconscious of the collective conscious of the elite, long before the elite actually know that those things exist there or want to admit that they exist there. The role of democracy wasn't to diffuse the economic power of the elite. The role of democracy, and this is also kind of where the danger lies in it, was to diffuse the ego's power within the upper class. It was meant to distribute those pressures which causes the elite to be distorted in their visions, in their views, in how they see their role in the society. It wasn't to rob them of that role. It was to force that role to be more centered on the desire of the Commonwealth. No, I didn't say the desire of the populace. Because the populace itself has its own miniature psychological cues. And the reason why I say miniature is because, as you'll find out in some of my other pieces, because this society is built on a European structure which was developed during the Ice Age, the populace has been taught over the last 10 plus thousand years to afford the upper elite the luxury of using their willpower to structure the society. And thus, the psychological imprintation of the masses, when you put it together, is less than the elite. Because the elite is borrowing some of that that psychological energy, if you would. So, democracy, in essence, was meant to first redirect that energy that people are often given to the elite to set the psychological agenda for the country and give it back to the people. The power's in the people. That's what they're talking about. And it's not to overrun the elite. It's to help guide the society in a mature way towards a conclusion that is beneficial for all people. Now, those people who raise the argument, and I think it's an apt argument, that, well, in history, populations haven't necessarily made the best choices. I think that's an apt argument. The problem with the argument suggests that the structures have been in place to ensure that they do make beneficial choices. You can't take a people who have been living in an authoritarian situation, which, let's be very frank, that is the model, even though we don't call it that, that has dominated, predominated European societies for 10,000 plus years, well into the Ice Age. You can't take a society that is used to those type of hierarchical structures and then give them the power to control anything without properly developing within them the sense that is necessary to fully analyze themselves, analyze their families, analyze their communities, and then communicate clearly without psychological distortion, psychological psychological disunification, without all those things that could muddy communication. You can't expect them to run the society in a brilliant way without giving them the tools necessary to analyze the situation correctly and then communicate not only the problem clearly, but also the solutions clearly. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, just as you had to teach people to live in an authoritarian arrangement, you have to teach them to live in a democracy-driven arrangement. That's the key there. And look, ladies and gentlemen, we are standing at one of those eras in time where the Republican style the Republican governing method, should I say, is being challenged on all sides because it no longer has the confidence of even the wealthy to produce the social stability that is required to make sure that any country, any nation state can survive past its 250th year. People forget, we're about to hit 200, this country, America, United States, 250 years in less than 6 years. We're about to get there. The Republican system is not meant to exist. I think forever. And I think this is the problem that the Romans faced, is instead of recognizing that they had to shift focus so that they integrated, and I use that word not as assimilated, which is what the Romans would have looked at it as, but so that they integrated as a move of showing unification. All of these disparate places that by some accounts they conquered and other times, they came into by decree and other activities. If they had worked to integrate these things and they had implemented a democracy-driven system, it's likely that the Roman Republic, which would have then been extensive, because it wouldn't have been just focused in Rome and in Italy, it would have been all of the parts that it annexed, they might have lasted a lot longer than they did. Because there would have been a true sense of unification across what we know today as the empire. The United States faces such a challenge right now. Republicanism is to me, is a system that is only meant to be trial and error. Its premises, which is to offer a communication system between the upper class and the lower class, is positive in the beginning because the upper class is humbled by their capacity to rule over the country, and the lower class, usually coming from a worse-off situation or a situation which they didn't find tenable, is willing to allow the people up top to rule until that humility wears off, and that seems to always happen. We are in a period of time where that humility has completely worn off. And in fact, some people might say that humility hasn't really existed since, what, the 1820s? That humility has been gone. And the fight has been to curtail and stop the crushing of the lower classes by the non-humbled people at the top, which is fair. And I think that would be, that would be something that would be right to say. As though we are standing on the brink of crossing that 250-year line, we already see what the Republicans committed to holding this system together are willing to do. We see it in the hyper-surveillance system that is being built up. We see it in the militarized police that are being projected across the country. We see it in the use of the phrases which were brought into popular consciousness after September 11th, those words being turned inwardly against protesters and people supposedly exercising their constitutional rights. We see what appears to be a group of technocratic people, not in the government. These are people who are business people who view the government as the problem and the people's ability to interact with the government as the problem. We see these people investing in structures that tamp down democracy, just as the Romans were hostile towards anything that wasn't complete surrender and submittance to their barbarism. Now, before somebody is like, wait a minute, are you saying that these people are barbaric? No. I'm saying that their actions are similar to that. Their motives are similar to that. These people believe they should be ruling and that the masses have no clue. That is a recipe for disaster. Now, the United States has flirted with authoritarianism, strict authoritarianism, before. And I'm not just talking about the 1930s here. I'm talking also about the 1890s, when the government was a subsidiary of big business. Where big business literally, in the 1880s too, and sometimes the 1870s, I believe, but the 1880s, 1890s, they had no problem, and even through the 1920s, had no problem with killing politicians who didn't do their bidding, killing labor leaders, exiling labor leaders. They were fundamentally against democracy. This type of flirtation is now bubbling up. We've seen it with Trump. And oftentimes when a sickness bubbles up in the body, people have one of two things that they can do. They can submit to it, realize it's there, and care for it. Or they can ignore it and let it fester and hope that it'll go away. I'm going to suggest that we do not hope that it goes away, because we've kind of been doing that now for the last 30 years. Okay, 20 years. 20. We've been doing that for 20 years. Family, the decision, therefore, is a difficult one. And it's not about politics purely. We have to decide if democracy is going to live. You have to understand, for democracy to live, you're going to have some economic power sharing. I find it interesting that during the civil rights movement, particularly the 1960s, at the same time that you had black people fighting for their right to be seen as equals in the society, you also had a movement, an academic movement, and this had been going on for some time, but the academic movement and the neoconservative movement, which, you know, we like to not acknowledge the fact that there was a lot of racism in that movement. They were arguing, as they were arguing that black people were inferior, some of them, they were also arguing that corporations were people, and that corporations should have the rights of people, and that corporations should be treated like people without the responsibility that citizens had, and that monopolies were good. Took a little bit longer into the 70s for that one to really sink in. That the limitations of the New Deal should be repealed so that monopolies could take shape across the country. You had, on the one hand, from a conscious democracy-driven place, you had these people calling first for black civil rights and then later on for human rights. Then on the other hand, from a corporatist, authoritarian-driven position, these other people calling for corporate rights and the right of corporations to rule over society. Those two conflicting and absolutely non-compatible visions are staring at us again. Republicanism as a governing method is dying. You can try to act like it's not, but it is. There is going to be major shifts, shakeups, changes, whatever you know you want to call it in this society. It's going to happen. Why? Because corporations are no longer seen as the saviors. Wall Street is no longer seen as beneficial. Politicians are seen as extensions of these corporations. And let me be clear here, ladies and gentlemen. I understand politicians are often beholden to corporations because corporations hold the power. You have a new mindset that don't see it that way anymore. The choice that we will have to make, ladies and gentlemen, is whether this society will be a Republican authoritarian society. And here, I'm not talking about totalitarianism. I'm talking straight up authoritarian, where everything comes from the top. And here, government isn't the top, ladies and gentlemen. It's the middle. Okay? It's the middle. The corporations are at the top. Will we allow that situation to govern us, to push us, to rule us? Or will we go towards a more democracy-based society? Now, what's going to come out at the end of all this, which is, I think, probably the most interesting part? I've mentioned this before when I talked about the Green New Deal. It was a couple of years back now. For me, the Green Revolution isn't just about technology, isn't just about recycling. For me, the Green Revolution is about decentralization. It's about putting the power back into communities. We need to dismantle the electrical grid across the country. How do you dismantle the electrical grid? You do one of two things. You either build a lot of community-based electrical plants, which you could do, and it would be a lot cheaper, or you develop technologies that enable houses to produce their own electricity, clean electricity, as much as they need, without limitation. This is what the Green Revolution is really about. The problem with the Green Revolution, and this extends, by the way, to water, to cleaning water, to recycling trash, to your economic structures being more cooperative-based, communally countywide and regionally, so people can, you know, keep their finances at home, making public transportation not only attractable, but also cost-effective, and changing the culture of society so we don't see public transportation as something poor people do. The problem with the Green Revolution, the real Green Revolution, not one that puts corporations first, but puts cooperatives first. The problem with it is if you have a rigid hierarchical system, it don't work. The real Green Revolution, as I described it there, takes away the need for rigid hierarchy and asks for consensus building, asks and demands that we all work together for the benefit of the planet and for the benefit of our communities and our countries and what have you, our families even. That is really why the Green Revolution is fought hard by places like Wall Street. Now, I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I expect Wall Street to go away to an extent in the next 20 or 30 years. Why? Because they're serving no purpose anymore. Well, we give people money. Yes. We keep the global economy going. No. No. Mm-mm. No, you don't do that. I wish you did it, but you don't. And so I think there's going to be a huge backlash generationally against Wall Street. Their greed has gotten absolutely out of control, and the markets that they interact with around the world has just gotten more and more greedy, which makes sense. I mean, truthfully, Wall Street was where the first slaves were sold and bought and what have you. Why would they change? Why would they change? They're still pimping slavery. They're still pimping enslavement of societies and countries and the like. Yeah. That competition concept that has fed them, that mind state is wearing off across the country. So, you know, like I said, I expect them to go away sometime in the next 20, 30 years. But we'll see. We have to make some tough decisions, ladies and gentlemen. I recently posted a COVID-19 extravaganza. It's an addendum, really. But it was like 7 hours worth of material that I had recorded over the last several months. And look, other people have seen what I saw very early on in this pandemic. It is, the crisis reveals the other crises, which are latent in global capitalism. This society's and this globe's going to have to change drastically. This is just another piece for us to consider in that changing. Questions, comments, concerns, reach out to me, y'all. As I said before, and I mean this, I'm going to be winding down Class War Battlefield Podcast. Though, that I won't say anything yet. But I am going to be winding down Class War Battlefield Podcast over the next few months. You know, putting a pin in it. So I can do the work that I wanted to do a couple of years back, which includes some creative writing and such, but you know, you'll be hearing from me, so keep looking out. I will do a final episode for the podcast, so it just won't end, okay? I'm your brother, Vimer Adis. Reach out to me if you have any questions, comments, concerns. See you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs on the radio.
again and again how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.